Welcome to Power Play on the day when disgraced Senator Dawn Meredith finally quit rather than risk becoming the first ever expulsion from the Red Chamber. A former Speaker of the Senate and Mr. Meredith's lawyer are standing by with reaction. Also coming up on today's show, it is Election Day in British Columbia as the Liberals attempt to extend their dynasty into a fifth consecutive term. We will size up the campaign highs and lows and what's at stake for the Trudeau government. Also, we have exclusive polling on which candidate Canadians believe can beat Justin Trudeau from the ranks of 13 conservative hopefuls. Nick Nano separates the contenders from the pretenders. And one contender is a big surprise. And it's a $35 billion federal economic stimulus bank, and the headquarters have gone to Toronto over a bid from Calgary. We will ask the MPs why the government is banking on a city bursting at the economic seams, while a city struggling to find a new industrial base was shut out. But first, the case against Dawn Meredith for sexual misconduct with a teenager resulted in him becoming the 185th senator to resign from Parliament rather than the first to be involuntarily forced out. The former Toronto pastor was appointed by Stephen Harper in 2010. He was investigated but never charged by police, but a Senate investigation or Senate Ethics Committee found him guilty of ethics violations after he admitted to having sex with a woman at 18, who he'd befriended as a 16-year-old. Meredith put out a statement that reads, in part, "I am acutely aware that the upper chamber is more important than my moral failings. After consulting with my family, community leaders, and my council over the past several weeks, I've decided to move forward with my life with the full support of my wife and my children. The path of expulsion being considered by my colleagues will have major implications for the Senate of Canada. This is a constitutional fight in which I will not engage." Well, with his resignation this afternoon, Meredith will be able to collect a pension of about $25,000. William Trudell is Mr. Meredith's lawyer. He joins us from Toronto. First off, Mr. Trudell, he actually has resigned, right? Because he never actually used the word in his statement.
He has resigned. He sent the letter to the Governor General, which is the procedure that has to be followed. So this was a statement, but also he sent the appropriate letter to the Governor General.
Okay, what made your client quit rather than fight?
Well, I think that he spent the last week or so talking to his family and deciding what was in the best interest of the country, which his statement addresses, and the best interests of his family, and decided, based upon the fact that the committee recommended expulsion, and the committee did not agree to the issue of suspension, which we suggested. So I think that Senator Meredith decided, looking at the big picture, that it was in everyone's interest that he take this step, and so he's done that.
It wasn't exactly an apology, but was it an admission of guilt in any way, or is this just he's just trying to avert attention or try to keep from a clash with the Senate that he might lose?
No, I think that's a bit unfair. Senator Meredith has accepted his responsibility. He's apologized. He's accepted accountability. He did that publicly, and he certainly did that in front of the committee. I think that what's important here to remember, if you don't mind my saying so, as you alluded to, and you mentioned this on previous programs that you have had, the Senate has never exercised this power. And this is a unique and important constitutional question that I really don't think has been settled. What the committee had, which was a report by counsel, I didn't see that report at the time we were in front of the committee, but that was the memorandum that they used, the Senate committee, and I take it the Senate themselves, to decide that they had the power to expel. They had to read that in. And we suggested that a suspension, a two-year suspension without pay, would be appropriate. The Senate committee decided that they did not have the power to do that. So this is a constitutional question that has not been reviewed by a court. I would hope that the Senate takes a look at this and decides that they may want to have extra judicial opinion outside of the Senate, because historically there has been a debate about it. I think the debate continues, and I don't think, quite frankly, that even though the memo is very well done, I don't think it's the final word, and I hope that the Senate is very careful in looking at it, because you know that senators had already decided, even before the report, that he should be expelled, and some senators said they had the numbers. So I don't think that there would be any doubt that had Senator Meredith taken the matter to his colleagues in the Senate, that he would not have been expelled.
Did you or him ever discuss that it really was a constitutional fight that you should take forward, given that this is setting precedent?
Well, I was on the file for about 6 weeks, it seems. The issue, I felt, was going to have to be addressed at some point in time, perhaps in the Senate itself. We talked about it. We did some limited research. I'm not a constitutional expert. I think what would have happened and may have been more helpful is if we had seen that report, and maybe that report could have been, get another opinion from a judge or even a reference to the Supreme Court of Canada, which is difficult in itself. So certainly we looked at it. Certainly we thought that it was a very complex issue that, excuse me, would have to be decided ultimately by a court or by a reference to the Supreme Court of Canada. I think that's still probably the case. So I don't think that the Senate's work is done in relation to the power to expel. If it ever happens that they sadly get to this point again, I hope that outside opinions are sought.
Okay, any final points on this? Just curious, any idea what Mr. Meredith's gonna do next? I mean, $25,000 pension isn't gonna carry him in a livelihood of any kind.
Well, he was a contributing member of the community prior to his appointment, and I think that probably he will re-engage with his community and go forward. You're right, the $25,000 pension is not enough to support his family, so he will find employment elsewhere.
Okay. Mr. Trudell, thanks for joining us. We appreciate your time. All right. For more reaction, we're joined by former Senate Speaker Leo Housakos. He's joining me here in the studio. Welcome to the program, sir. Nice to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
I mean, a long, dark chapter, I guess, is closed here. I'm just curious what your reaction is.
Well, it is sad on so many fronts. It's sad for the young lady that was taken advantage of in this particular instance. It's sad for our colleague who showed bad judgment and faces the consequences. And it's particularly sad for the institution that we had to go through this sordid affair.
Are you relieved that you don't have to engage what Mr. Trudell was describing on this constitutional fight?
Well, I'm relieved that the Senate's code of ethics, which we've put into place now for a number of years, and we've had a lot of confidence that it's the most rigid code of ethics in all of the Commonwealth, has withstood this test. And it has shown unequivocally that the Senate will not tolerate behavior of this nature from our colleagues.
Was there any doubt in your mind that Don Meredith was a goner either way? He had to resign or he was going to be tossed out of the red chamber by a majority vote?
No, I think at the end of this exercise, there's no doubt about it, because we have to remember it was a 2-year investigation. Mm-hmm. The Senate Ethics
you
Officer...
You started it, right?
I did send in the request back in 2015, and the Senate Ethics Officer took a long time, was very thorough, very diligent, gave Senator Meredith due process, mm-hmm. Brought him before her. The report was unequivocal and clear. Then our Senate Ethics Committee as well, led by Senator Ronell Andrichuk and some very respected jurists from the Senate, also came forward with a report equally unequivocal, mm-hmm. which gave us solid legal grounds and solid way forward of how to deal with this. So we weren't rash about this. If anything, people can say it took a long time, and it took a long time because the Parliament of Canada takes these things very seriously.
I know there was some talk in the House of Commons that Don Meredith didn't deserve his pension. Is that in any doubt, or is he entitled to and therefore he gets it?
Well, we're an independent house, and we have the freedom to dole out the discipline, as we did in this particular instance. When it comes to parliamentary pensions, they do fall under the Treasury Act. And as a result, both Senate and House of Commons pensions are under the management of the Treasury Board. So this decision falls squarely on the shoulders of Prime Minister Trudeau and the government in terms of what to do with his pension.
Oh, really? They get to make the call?
Absolutely. The Senate Ethics Committee can only apply the ethics code. We had the right to discipline, to expel, to suspend. But when it comes to the pensions are, again, Treasury Act managed in Parliament.
Well, I'm going to put you on the Which in the test, should he get a pension in your view?
I don't think so. I think public trust for parliamentarians is fundamental. And when we're named to the Senate of Canada, tremendous privileges and responsibilities come with it. And when we conduct ourselves in a deplorable fashion that's not becoming of a senator, in this particular instance, many senators feel that this behavior was the most egregious. I think he should not be benefiting from a pension, but that's my personal opinion.
Well, your opinion carries some weight over there, so let's see what happens. I'm curious if you think that you've isolated the damage to the Senate, or is there still going to be a taint that lingers from this whole Meredith scandal?
Well, I think it's important to recognize the Senate is a mirror image of society, with some of the best and some of the worst. And we have never, and we've never wavered when it comes to bad behavior and sweeping things under the carpet. We've never denied poor behavior. We've dealt with it head on. We're the ones that brought in the Auditor General when there was a question of inappropriate spending. The other House and no other parliament has done that. We're also the ones that have disciplined in an unprecedented way former colleagues for inappropriate spending. And again, one more step forward on this particular instance, we have found behavior that's inappropriate and we've taken, again, unprecedented steps. So the Senate has shown no malleability when it comes to dealing with poor behavior. And I think as a result, people have to recognize that the Senate as an institution takes transparency, accountability, and integrity very seriously.
Do you think that this opens the door to more expulsions? And where's the line between ethical violations that are can send someone out of the Senate versus those that don't?
The vast majority of senators take their public trust very seriously. Mm-hmm. And I think the message today to all senators, and I think we all recognize that there will be zero tolerance for this type of behavior. So senators don't take, disciplining a member and expelling a member from parliament lightly. And this wasn't taken lightly. We know it's unprecedented, but we also believe for the good of the institution and for that public trust, it mm-hmm. needed to be done.
But you'll know an expulsion-worthy behavior when you see it, or is there going to have to be a guideline that'll be put down in paper? Because this is entering into new territory.
Our code, like I said, it's very rigid. It's very mm-hmm. clear. We've put it into place now for a number of years, yeah. And we have confidence in it. And I think we all have read it. We all approved it a number of years when it passed, and we stand by it.
All right, Senator. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
All right. Coming up, our MPs discuss a massive federal government-funded bank that will be located in Toronto, despite a determined bid from an economically battered Calgary to land the headquarters. Please stay with us.
Liberal insiders, investment bankers, $35 billion in tax money, and Liberal politicians who have control over how the bank is actually run. How? What could possibly go wrong?
The so-called infrastructure bank will, quote, provide loan guarantees to provinces and municipalities to ensure that the projects are built. Funny. Nothing in here about corporations profiting from public infrastructure. They must have left that out by accident.
In order to meet the needs of Canada's investments in infrastructure, that what Canadians and communities need, we are looking at many different ways, including historic investments of $180 billion over the coming years in infrastructure, but how we can even push that money further, how we can create more infrastructure that's going to benefit Canadians.
All right, our Tuesday trio of trouble is here. Three fine MPs with strong opinions to debate. Marco Mendicino is a Liberal MP from Toronto. Karen Vecchio is a Conservative MP from southwestern Ontario. And Jenny Kwan is an NDP MP from Election Central tonight in Vancouver. Welcome to you all.
Hey, Don.
Hi. We shared those clips on this infrastructure bank, and Calgary pushed hard for that. Montreal tried a little bit too, and I guess it's a prestigious thing as much as it is an employment opportunity. But you're from the West, Jenny. Was this a snub?
Well, I got to tell you, the infrastructure bank, who's it going to benefit? The multinationals. This is exactly who the government brought into the inside to really structure this thing. They've actually even made a decision to set up the head office in Toronto before the issue has even been brought to committee for a full debate. So this is supposedly transparent, but really, who's paying the price? It's taxpayers who's paying the price, and the Liberals are doing this to line their pockets for their friends and insiders.
Well, are you questioning the bank or the location or both?
Well, I'm questioning the entire decision from the government. There's no transparency on this. And really, at the end of the day, who's going to pay? And I suspect, and I would be ready and willing to wager in the fact that there will be fees that taxpayers would have to pay, user fees, and the transfer of the cost is going to be onto them. And, we all know this. governments have the best borrowing rate. What is this all about, except to line the pockets of multinationals?
Yeah, that's a point former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page has made. You know, is there really the economics to support it? All right, let's talk location, location, location here,
well,
Karen.
You know, I'm with Jenny on this one, too. We can talk location, but the fact is we're putting a location before we've even started to discuss it. And I think there's a lot of problematic issues there. We know that it's costing taxpayers $35 billion. We know that at the end of the day, it's taxpayers on the line. And we also know that it was discussed with many, many people, including BlackRock, how they're going to formulate, how they're going to put out money. And at the end of the day, it's going to where they're located as well. So we have to recognize that this is a really small group of people making decisions. It's not being the government of Canada. And I'm very concerned with what they're doing. There's going to be zero transparency, especially when it's only brought twice every 10 years. Or every 10 years, it's going to be twice brought to the parliamentary.
All right, Marco of Toronto. I got to ask you, though. I mean, I'm from I have some Calgary DNA in me. And I just can't believe that. I know it makes sense maybe from a pure financial standpoint to be in the financial center of Canada with this infrastructure bank. But Calgary needs a leg up right now. And Toronto, they're trying to, no one can afford to move there. Why would you put such a big economic stimulus project in a city that doesn't need it?
Well, Calgary is going to get support, and all Canadians are going to get support. And here's what we know. After 10 years of anemic growth under the last government, our party was elected on a platform to invest in infrastructure.
Right.
$180 billion over a number of years, of which $15 billion will be contributed towards this investment bank. And the real important point to take away for your viewers, Don, is not where the location of this bank will be in the end, but what it delivers, which will be better roads, better transit, clean water, and a sustainable economy and jobs.
How many
and
people
that's
are we
matters.
Talking about? How many people will the infrastructure bank actually hire?
Well, that will be part of the ongoing consultation process, and I would respectfully disagree with my friends Karen and Jenny. The consultations have been broad. They haven't just been with private enterprise, which we need to work with, but also with labor and with other deliverers of services, which will be who will be working together collaboratively to deliver on infrastructure.
I'll tell you, Calgary leads the way in terms of public-private partnerships. They basically got the concept off the ground. It seems to me they'd be the ideal place to
I said before, I think that Calgarians and Albertans will be winners in this, as will all provinces. But we need to infuse investment and we need to build infrastructure, and that's what this bank is designed to do.
But just on that, though, I mean, during the campaign, you don't hear the Liberals saying that they're going to put forward a privatized scheme with their infrastructure bank to build infrastructure. They've never told Canadians that. And here we are after the election. What are they doing? Doing a privatized scheme through this infrastructure bank that's going to cost taxpayers money. And really, that money is much needed on the actual infrastructure,
There is more than enough evidence that for every dollar that you spend on infrastructure, you get a better return.
Well, tell me actually,
could just be permitted to finish.
Just the question, what's the borrowing rate going to be? Is it going to be better than the government borrowing rate?
If I could just be permitted to finish, thanks.
Answer that question.
What I would say is that we were elected on investing in infrastructure and we're delivering on that promise with this bank.
I got to move on because we could talk about this all day and we wouldn't get any further than we are right now. That Bombardier got a lot of government money, both from Quebec and the federal government, $1.3 billion to build this passenger jet. Interestingly, the government really didn't do anything besides tisk about this, but it's interesting. Two huge investors in Bombardier, the Teachers' Pension Plan of Ontario, as well as the CAISSE, Quebec Pension Plan, have said, we don't want that chairman to get reappointed. This whole compensation package has made it very distasteful. I just sort of wonder why the government didn't join the chorus a little more forcefully, Karen?
I 100% agree with you on that. I think that if these two operations are saying we don't have confidence in them, why does the Canadian government have confidence in them? That is one of my big concerns, and I hope that they're asking these questions. Bombardier paid huge amounts to their executives. I think it went up $12 million between 2015 and 2016. They're showing zero credibility, so why are we putting the confidence in them? So I really, truly hope the government is questioning themselves on what they're doing with that.
I'll go to you next, if you don't mind. You've got a
I don't mind.
Response?
Yes, very simply, the government has confidence in the aerospace sector, which produces $28 billion in GDP per year, 211,000 jobs. And the purpose in collaborating with Bombardier is to ensure that we are investing in research and development in the C-Series, and that will produce up to 1,300 new jobs. So Obviously, there has been some concerns expressed about the CEO. We see that as largely being a matter for between the shareholders and the management of Bombardier, and that will play itself out. But in the meantime, it's important that the government maintain confidence in an important sector of the economy, which will produce jobs and growth.
You know, I was told that the governance structure was the reason this took a long time to come together, that the federal government was concerned about the people at the top. Do you think they should have put a string attached to their money and said the chair's got to go because, you know, he's
well, I don't think Canadians expected for the federal government to put money into job creation and for that big chunk of money, and we're talking about over $32 million to go line the pockets of CEOs. That's not what people expected. That's not what people want to see. So absolutely, there needs to be accountability to that, and the government needs to take action to make sure that money is spent where it's supposed to be, and that is to create jobs for Canadians.
All right, let's have some fun. There was an interesting question today.
We were already.
The official opposition leader asked the prime minister an interesting question about a certain cardboard issue. Let's hear Ron Ambrose and Justin Trudeau.
We have found out that the government ordered 14 full-size cardboard cutouts of the prime minister. I'd like to give him a chance to explain this, but I'm worried that his explanation might fall flat. And, Mr. Speaker, he's not going to be able to just paper over this with his explanation. So instead of his one-dimensional answers, will the Prime Minister tell us, shouldn't this idea have just gone into the recycle bin?
One of the differences between us and the previous government is we believe in giving our diplomatic missions the independence to make their own decisions and to make their own choices. That is something that matters on the world stage, to trust our diplomats to represent us well around the world and respect the choices they make.
All right, so this is a foreign affairs policy move, I guess. I want to couple that to two other quick things. One, the government spent $30,000 on tickets to Broadway's Come From Away for people that weren't just politicians. Mm-hmm. There were some pretty hefty business interests in there. And there's $111,000 patronizing a ritzy Rito club down here for Crown corporations and agencies. So, Marco, I guess we should get to the one-dimensional answers now. Really, seriously, should the government be paying that kind of money for cardboard cutouts of the prime minister in order to sort of act as Canada's out on the world stage? And here's your chance to meet the prime minister in almost real life.
Well, without wanting to diminish the question, I even think if you listen carefully to the Leader of the Opposition, she was delivering it almost tongue-in-cheek. Look, the Prime Minister, I think, gave an effective response, and that is that we do respect the independence of our diplomatic corps to make decisions about how they advertise Canada abroad and how they build relationships abroad. And with respect to the other two questions which you posed to me, just very quickly on the memberships over at the Rideau Club, those are arm's length agencies of the government, and we're reviewing the policy that does allow for certain memberships to be paid for. So we're going to take a hard look at that. And then on Come From Away, you know, like many Canadians, I think we were very proud on 9/11 when the people of Newfoundland and Labrador welcomed those stranded in the air or who would have been stranded in the air and gave them safe harbor at a moment of need. And so this play is, I think, an homage to that moment, which we can all be proud about. It's about building relationships, as the Minister for Global Affairs said today. And so I think this is these are good relationship building exercises, which we can all be proud of.
Nothing tongue in cheek about that answer. All right, Karen, cardboard first.
I feel really sorry for my friend Marco, who's having to answer that question.
Yes,
well. It is.
That's the fate of Liberal MPs.
I'm really, really sorry that you have to answer that question. The fact is, if we're going to send out an ambassador, yes, he is our prime minister. He should be out there. But cardboard cutouts, my son does have one at Sidney Crosby because he idolizes him and he's a celebrity. But this is about being a celebrity. It's not being about politics and policy. So let's not go there. We also know that with these tickets that they bought, about $30,000 in tickets to go to Broadway. These were people that not only could afford them, but they go to these things all the time. Yes, it's celebrating what we did in 9/11, and I respect that, but people can afford those tickets. It's not up to the Canadian taxpayers to pay for those. and the Rideau Club membership. So that's just another joke. But I think taxpayers' money is just going down the drain. And I really feel sorry for some of our MPs that are on the Liberal side that have to stick up for stupidity like that. Just stupid things.
You don't think we should have a nice cardboard cutout of Tom Mulcair? You know, we can all stand beside.
Well, I got to tell you, I didn't realize foreign policy and foreign affairs is about a vanity project, because that's what those cardboard cutouts are. And it's a promotion of the image of the prime minister. And guess what? The cardboard doesn't talk. So they're not out there promoting Canadian values and putting forward what we believe in on behalf of all Canadians. So, you know, it just goes to show you, really, the mindset of the prime minister and the Liberal government is all about them, is all about their image. When it comes to action and something that counts on the ground, they're not there. It just all sums it up. All up, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Cardboard cutouts. That's the policy of this government.
Don't you think it would have been?
Well, you know, look, I do have to
selfies.
Say,
selfies.
I do. There is a bit of amnesia that's being suffered by my friend Karen. Not that she was responsible for it, because she wasn't a member of parliament in the last administration, but there was $750 million spent in the last conservative government on advertising, which was widely derided as being a waste of taxpayer dollars.
So
just to be fair,
you're way off there.
The conservative wasted taxpayers' money on advertising. The Liberals are doing more of the same, and now with real images of a cardboard cutout of the Prime Minister. Why don't we spend that money on where it counts? We have people who are homeless. We have Aboriginal people who don't have access to education. We have housing issues.
I'm not sure $2,000 would do much, but anyway.
Let's get on with it. That's just a symptom of all the problems,
That was more fun than normal, but okay. Thank you all. We will move along. Thanks again.
See
you guys next week. Coming up, we have an exclusive Power Play poll from Nick Nanos asking Canadians which Conservative leadership hopeful can defeat Justin Trudeau. The findings might surprise you. Please stay with us. Okay, the Conservative leadership decision is 18 days away and 13 hopefuls remain in the running. PowerPlay commissioned Nick Nanos of Nanos Research to poll Canadians on which candidate they believe has the right stuff to challenge Justin Trudeau in the 2019 election. Nick is here to translate his findings. All right. So the question was, who has the right stuff to beat Justin? What did you find?
Well, you know, what we find is top answer, unsure at 37%, followed by none of the above or no one can beat them at 20.2. But that's the bad news for the Conservatives. The good news for some of the Conservative candidates, at least, is that when we ask Canadians which candidate has the best chance to beat Trudeau, at the top of the list was Maxime Bernier at 20%. Number two was Michael Chong at 7.
Wait a minute. I got to stop you there. Michael Chong. Number two. Michael Chong, who most people thought is way down in the lineup, is number two.
Well,
this is all Canadians.
This is about who Canadians think could best beat the Conservatives. Perhaps the Conservatives can have a discussion amongst themselves and decide whether this election is about winning or about having the most popular candidate. Because if the election is about who has the best chance to defeat Justin Trudeau, at the top of the list would be Maxime Bernier or Michael Chong. But that doesn't mean that they're going to win the leadership, because that's a popularity contest within the Blue Tribe.
But that's the disconnect, right, between the Conservatives and the rest of Canada, is Michael Chong stands for, among other things, a carbon tax. He gets booed at every time there's a leadership debate for doing that. Yet here he is, and I would still say that's a very strong second, because the next one's Lisa Raitt, and she hasn't even got half of what he does in terms of poll support.
Realistically, after Maxime Bernier and Michael Chong, you have the third level, which includes Lisa Raitt, Andrew Scheer, Aaron O'Toole, and Kelly Leach, and then we'll call the rest, who we shall not mention, who are at 1%. Or less than 1%.
Yeah, combined, they don't even equal 2.5%.
So really, this is a six-person race. And Maxime Bernier, at least is seen by Canadians as having the best chance to defeat Justin Trudeau compared to the other choices, with Michael Chong second.
I think it's also interesting, Kelly Leach, because this, as you say, is an all-Canadian poll. But in conservative world, Kelly Leach is selling a lot more memberships than that percentage indicates. So I guess that's another sign of the great divide between Canadians in general and Conservative Party specifically.
And, you know, Kelly Leach has also done a very effective job at raising funds. You know, this does not correlate or relate to the funds that the different candidates have raised, because some of those other candidates have actually raised more funds than Michael Chong. What it shows, at least, is that right now Maxime Bernier is perceived by Canadians as more likely being able to defeat Justin Trudeau compared to the others, and that Michael Chong is in the second position, at least among Canadians.
You know, the other follow-up thing you did was talk about where these what regions these come from, and I'm quite surprised. I mean, look, there's across-the-board strength for Bernie and Chong there.
Yeah, exactly. What the research shows is that when we unpack this right across the country, is that the only two candidates that actually have a national impact in terms of Canadians are Maxime Bernier and Michael Chong. Maxime Bernier comes first in all the different regions across the country, and then when we look at Michael Chong, he's actually second or third in every region. Mm-hmm. And then when we get beyond that, we have kind of regional candidates like Stephen Blaney, who does better in Quebec than in other areas, and Lisa Raitt, who does better in Ontario.
Are you surprised, just flipping back initially, the first set of figures that, you know, almost 40% of Canadians just are unsure? Does that surprise you, or does that reflect the fact that 40% of Canadians would never entertain it being a Conservative member to begin with?
Well, it actually doesn't surprise me, because it's kind of like going to a restaurant and having too many things on the menu, mm-hmm. right? it's just, you know, when there are too many things on the menu, people just turn off. And I think, you know, for the Conservatives, you know, if they were to remanufacture this leadership race, probably the one thing they probably should have figured out is how to have fewer people in the race at the very end, because there are too many people on the menu right now.
And how demoralized should they be that none of the above can defeat Justin Trudeau in the opinion of 20% of Canadians?
Exactly. Well, this speaks to the fact that Justin Trudeau, love him or hate him, does have a following, and that for a certain proportion of Canadians, one out of every five, they don't think anyone can defeat the current Prime Minister.
Interesting stuff. Nick, we really appreciate you doing the poll for us. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome back. Well, it's voting day in British Columbia, where nobody wants to definitively predict the election result because polls failed so miserably to detect the 2013 Liberal majority victory. Christy Clark is aiming for a fifth consecutive Liberal mandate. Let's find out how the campaign went for her and her chief rival NDP leader, John Horgan, with the Globe and Mail's Ian Bailey is coming to us from Vancouver. Ian, is it a bit of an exaggeration to suggest we're at a bit of a crossroads here between two visions of British Columbia's future, sort of resource development and pipelines versus the opposite?
Absolutely, Don. I mean, the parties are very, the Liberals and the New Democrats, of course, either of whom could end up forming government, are sort of heading in two different directions. I know, you know, the Liberals are sort of going to accept expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline controversial project. NDP, no way, no how would they allow that to go ahead. So, yeah, it's kind of a really interesting election, and a lot of differences as well on new programs, $10 daycare if the New Democrats win, something the Liberals wouldn't agree to, so on. Yeah, it's very different. Two parties are going in very different directions, depending on who ends up in charge tomorrow morning.
I want to tell you, I think there's some nervousness around Ottawa if the NDP wins. Do you sense the Trudeau government's, you know, cheering for Clark and maybe even helping her a little bit?
Well, you know, during the campaign, the Prime Minister sort of endorsed a proposal by Christy Clark to sort of look at imposing levies on something called thermal coal and also sort of banning thermal coal exports. Now, this is something that, you know, by intervening, the Trudeau government gave Ms. Clark something to talk about, gave some weight to this proposal she was talking about, which was an advantage for her in the campaign. Obviously, nothing obvious, but they did help her in that way.
I think you made that your what Christy Clark did right in one of your stories this week. I'm curious, what did she do wrong in your view?
Well, there was an incident with a voter. Hashtag I am Linda came to be known as. Ms. Clark encountered a voter who, in a sunny day in a nice market, who boldly said she would never vote for her. Ms. Clark sort of said that was her right via democracy. But after that, Liberals started claiming this woman, a retired civil servant named Linda Higgins, was an NDP plant. And Ms. Clark then elaborated in very odd ways on the conversation these two had. allegations that were disputed by video of the event. I think what happened there is that this is something they did wrong. This gave sort of Ms. Clark's rivals something to rally around on social media. I checked before coming on the air. There are still postings on I Am Linda. I think Ms. Clark missed an opportunity to sort of, you know, show that she was more considerate, confound the suggestion she was all partisan and willing to do anything to win.
All right. What did the NDP leader, John Horgan, do right and wrong in your view?
Well, you know, I covered the NDP campaign a lot in 2013. I covered Mr. Horgan this time around. I'd say one thing he did right was he was very focused and disciplined in his messaging. John Horgan attacked Christy Clark, something his predecessor declined to do 4 years ago. And he was very clipped and focused in talking about a $10 daycare, something we point out today about sort of measures for renters and other things. He was very focused in sort of hammering that out through the campaign. Something he did wrong was the first debate, a radio debate that was also televised regionally around the Lower Mainland, in which I've never seen someone go after his rival as much as John Horgan did. It's worth watching if you can find it. Ms. Clark touched his hand at one point because he was a bit worked up that he wasn't getting enough time, he claimed. He turned to her and said, "Don't touch me." Now, he claimed, maybe more New Democrats claimed that, you know, he was rallying the NDP base, but it's notable that in the subsequent big province-wide debate, Mr. Horgan toned it down. So clearly that was something he did wrong.
I'll give you 10 seconds or less. Do you want to venture a prediction here, Ian?
Don, this one is too close to tell. It honestly is. I can see either John Horgan or Christy Clark being premier tomorrow. I think the NDP has a tough path to victory, something we've been hearing, those words, path to victory, tonight, but anything's possible.
Well, that was a very diplomatic answer, Ian. Thanks for joining us. We'll see what happens tomorrow morning.
We all will. Thanks a lot, Don.
All right, coming up, the Prime Minister's announced flood relief for Quebec. We'll discuss that and Don Meredith's resignation with our press gallery. That's coming up next. Please stay with us. All right, just a bit of breaking news that's just coming across the wires from the White House that Donald Trump has fired FBI Director James Comey. He's been removed from office, and I guess that has probably something to do with his testimony earlier this week. All right, on to domestic politics. Even as the waters begin to recede, there are pockets of grumbling about the slow federal response to the Quebec flooding devastation. The Prime Minister announced funding for the relief effort earlier today.
In addition to our support on the ground, we're pleased to announce that the federal government will allocate $1 million to the Red Cross to help with immediate relief.
All right, let's discuss this and the controversial rise, fall, and historical implications of former Senator Don Meredith and disgraceful behavior. That's with our illustrious duo of press gallery veterans. Tonda McCharles writes for the Toronto Star. Stephanie Levitz writes for the Canadian Press.
Hello.
Is there any justification, any grumbling about how this government's handled the flooding in your
view?
Well,
look, I mean, I think that the $1 million goes straight to the Red Cross for immediate needs,
right.
But the government's been pretty clear from the get-go that any asks will be met, basically. You know, they've sent out the army once it was requested, and Goodale has gone out of his way, the public safety minister, to say there will be more relief coming. You know, there's processes to follow, but in the immediate emergency, they're there. They're standing by, ready to do what's asked of them. So I think, you know, at this point, it's a bit early to say, to crap on them for not doing something. I mean, you know, he went and did sandbags in Montreal, and he hasn't showed up in Gatineau, but, you know, across the river, David Johnston, the governor general, went. So
yeah.
I'd say give it a few days. Let's see what they're not doing. We don't know yet what they're not doing. Seems to me they're everywhere.
What are they not doing?
And that's what that's up to the people to make the demand. I think Tom's point is well put. If there's an ask that's not being met and it's a real legitimate ask that only the federal government can provide, be it money, resources, perhaps bags to put sand in, those could be helpful. you know, the government, if they step up, great, and if they don't, they can be held to account for that.
There are probably questions, larger questions to be asked about disaster response in the country. You know, should we always have to call in the army? Should we have, you know, better civilian sort of forces to stand up when this happens? But those are longer term questions.
I had to laugh at Justin Trudeau said, "Oh yeah, of course we're not going to bill the provinces for our military assistance this morning." When was the last time military assistance came with a bill for a province or a municipality. I don't think that's ever been done, has it?
I don't think.
All right. I didn't want to put you on the spot. I'm just musing out loud.
Calgary floods. I don't think.
No, I don't like the Calgary floods. All right, Don Meredith, gone, gone, gone. Curious way of doing it, though he actually sent the letter and it didn't say he was going
to... Well, actually, he sent an email. He sent an email to the Governor General. Yeah, and, you know, that actually doesn't fly. You have to actually send a formal notice, a formal letter, a hard copy, here you go, and indicate what date you're resigning by, which he hadn't done.
Has he saved the Senate a lot of headaches with constitutional wrangling and stuff, or do you think that
saved them any headaches?
Well, he could have engaged, I guess, a fight to the finish, right?
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I heard a lot of people, including his lawyer, talk about how, you know, confusing and unclear that would be and how long that battle could go. Really, could it have gone very long?
He was gone anyway, right?
Long gone, and let's face it. I mean, there's a question now. I mean, you know, there was never a vote put to the senators. Could he have lost? Is there any chance he might have withstood a vote up there? I don't think.
I don't think so. Do you, Steph?
I don't know. I mean, you have Ann Coulls, right? For what that's worth, though, but that's one senator. If the idea was that the vote had to be unanimous or, you know... What was the outcome there? What did they need? If they needed everyone on side, we know at least one who wasn't on side. And so that could have been a potential problem for the Senate. But, of course, now it moves on to the discussion of his pension. And the reality is that, you know, he is entitled to one. He clocked in his 6 years as of last December. And so the question now becomes for the Senate, are you going to let him walk away with that money?
And it was interesting to hear Senator Housakos on your show say, actually, it's not up to us, it's up to the Treasury Board president. Because when I was part of a group that scrummed Scott Bryson after QP today, right after Meredith's resignation was made public, and he said, oh, well, you know, we won't have any comment until the Senate has dealt with it. The Senate will have a say in this. So, you know, it's like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing on this question. You'd think they'd have had their lines prepared for this day since they expected him to go.
Yeah. Well, you think they would have had it prepared after the Duffy scandal. I mean, you think there would have been a point at which everyone examined all the available options to, A, get a senator out of the Senate, B, rescind his pension, if so do, all his entitlements, benefits, hers, whatever, that it would all be mapped out somewhere in some book that, here, crisis, this is what we do. And clearly that didn't happen.
Has the barrel isolated the bad apple and thrown it out, and so it saves the rest? Or do you think this is going to linger a little bit around as a PR disaster?
You know, it's interesting. Tom Mulcair had something to say today about why didn't they get rid of him earlier. No delay. Like, it was pretty clear as soon as that ethics committee report came down, you know, expel him, make a vote, expel the man, and then you could have dealt with the question of a pension in a little bit more clear form. But since they gave him, you know, a little more than a week to resign, you know, to come to his senses and resign, some of these questions are left outstanding. I'm with Mulcair on that. I think, why didn't they act sooner?
I guess due process, I suppose. I don't know, but due process, 2 years.
There wasn't due process in that he could have responded himself. He was invited to have a word. You know, that could have happened all quickly.
Steph, you are covering the Conservative leadership race like a blanket.
How many more days?
Yeah. Yes, 17, but who's 18? Who's counting?
Your phone.
I kind of thought this poll was kind of interesting. We took a bit of a flyer because I said to Nick, we'll just ask questions about everybody, and look who won. Not sure anyone can beat Justin Trudeau, becomes the winner. But look at the top two, Bernier and Chong. That's Canadian speaking, not conservative necessarily, but it's interesting.
I find it really interesting, and I'll tell you why. These are the two candidates who are proposing in their own platforms what you might call big ideas, which are things that are not traditionally spoken about in the Conservative Party. So, of course, in Max Bernier's case, the hallmark one is supply management. In Mike Chong's case, the hallmark one is a carbon tax. And I think it's interesting that Canadians are responding to that to the extent that they are in this survey, because to me it signals a willingness on the part of Canadians to entertain the Conservatives if the Conservatives will come at them with a vision for the country. And one of the biggest knocks against the Harper Conservatives was that they weren't people of vision. They were incrementalists, and their vision was achieved incrementally. It wasn't achieved through these big ideas that Canadians were used to. Pan-Canadian healthcare, all these big projects, right? And the Liberals are the king and queen of these big projects. Yeah. So I just find this poll interesting in that regard, because it seems like maybe there is an appetite for the Conservatives to the extent which people are saying, give me a vision. Tell me how you see the country, what you think we need to do. And I guess those two are speaking loudest to that.
And no appetite for Kelly Leach.
Which is...
And her alleged big immigration idea, or some people say very small immigration idea.
Right, exactly. A repudiation of that to some extent on the part of Canadians, again, writ large. And then regionally it's different, and we'll see how it plays out in the race itself.
I don't think this is at all reflective however, of Conservative Party members and how they feel. Mm-hmm. I do not see that Michael Chong is the second choice, albeit at a very small number, of most Conservative Party members, nor do I think that most Conservative Party members think Michael Chong's the guy who's going to beat Justin Trudeau. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that, you know, people might be open to a vision coming at them, maybe a big vision, they're looking for something, but I don't think Max Bernier's big vision is the one that most either Conservatives or Canadians would go for. A plurality, he could win on it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, but I think in terms of a majority of Canadians, I don't think that Max Bernier's, you know, low tax, get the feds out of health care, like he's basically rewriting the rules of the Federation, right? And getting rid of supply management for dairy and poultry, that's a good idea perhaps with some Conservatives, but not a big idea with all Conservatives nor all Canadians.
I've only got 30 seconds left, but, you know, one thing about this, though, is that it's...
But that doesn't mean he won't win.
It's across the country for Bernier. That's what I find interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
You know, BC, Alberta... Even in Atlantic Canada, he's number one. But I must say something.
It says something about charisma. It says something about, you know, just general appeal of a person who cuts a good figure in a suit, who people are saying,
hard work.
If I see you up against Trudeau, this is what, you know, I see you as a foil.
He's worked his butt off.
We're out of time.
We're done.
I'm sorry. Thank you for the discussion. All right. That's it for today's Political Power Plays. Jennifer Burke is standing by with the latest news headlines. Thanks for watching the broadcast or listening to the podcast. Here's how you can reach us with reactions or ideas. We're back tomorrow with all the big moves from Parliament Hill across the country or around the world. Hope you can join us at this time on CTV News Channel.